Hello and welcome to the Intrafish Podcast, where we bring you the week's most interesting and compelling seafood news. I'm editor Drew Cherry, joined by executive editor John Fiorillo. Another busy week in seafood news, and we're going to talk about just a couple of stories today, and then be joined at the end by Ignacio Kleiman, who is going to talk to us about mergers, acquisitions, and the climate for consolidation around the globe in seafood. Stay tuned for that at the end. First, we decided to talk a bit about some numbers coming out of the food service sector. Now, we've spent a lot of time discussing retail and some really, really sour numbers. But food service is one where the bag is a little bit more mixed in both good and bad ways. Now, we all know COVID decimated the food service sector, but then we saw a strong bounce back after that and some opportunities opened up for seafood. But some new data and some reporting from our colleague John Evans shows that maybe long term might not be as bright as we all might hope for the sector.
Yeah, I think the part that's most concerning, if you're a seafood company, is that during the pandemic we lost 110,000 restaurants by one estimate, by National Restaurant Association estimate. That's bad enough, obviously. Some of them temporarily, a lot of them permanently. And the ones that we did lose were where seafood really stars as a center of the plate attraction or protein. And those are the white tablecloth, the higher end spectrum of the food service sector. And those have been very slow to recover, to reopen in any sense or anything like that. They're generally, one person or, single operators. They're not part of a chain. So, there's a lot of risk opening a restaurant, obviously. So, and with money tight, this year didn't help either. So, upon losing that valuable segment to some degree, we did, however, see another end of the spectrum really start to blossom as a result of COVID. And that's basically fast food and what they call fast casual, which is like a Chipotle or, somewhere you could go in and sit down, but get, kind of quick service food. Those have been doing well. Those have been growing in number. There are more of those quick service restaurants today than before the pandemic. The challenge there, however, is that seafood doesn't, there's not a lot of seafood at that level. I mean, there's obviously fish sandwiches in the fast food arena. Lots of shrimp kind of gets thrown in as ingredients in fast casual, shrimp tacos, that type of stuff. And there are others, but it's not a place where seafood stars like it does in the higher end. And, at the high end restaurants, it can command much bigger prices, much better prices. So that's kind of the backdrop for where we are right now. And then we'll see how this year unfolds. Most of the projections for growth are very tepid in the 1%, 2% range tops. Now, they may set a value record, but you have to build in inflation and, menu pricing into all that. But when it comes to actual growth of the sector, it's going to be pretty flat this year. So, it's probably not the forecast seafood suppliers want to hear, but that's the present state of the state, so to speak.
Well, and I wish the news were better in other countries, but unfortunately it's not. And in some cases, it's worse. And, most of the analyses of the restaurant and food service sectors around the globe tend to highlight as the number one cause of any drop off, the inflation in prices. Now, I found very interesting in John's reporting. There was a State of the Seafood Market report. It surveyed 250 food service operators on the biggest barriers to increasing seafood offerings. And it was quite fascinating. You know, the 49% of them said food costs and higher menu prices were a barrier. Not a whole lot the industry can do about that. That's something that you can't just simply start, you know, having your company go under so that you can meet the needs of a consumer. That's just a fact. However, you know, what I thought was interesting, and I think this goes, again, globally, are the issues that can that the seafood industry can do something about. And there's interesting things on there that the food service operators said. They said they had challenges sourcing fresh seafood consistently, lack of recipe ideas or menu item inspiration. Those can be met. Those can be overcome. Issues like sustainability and food waste, you know, those to me, the seafood industry has a very good sustainability story compared to other proteins. And so, and food waste as well, I think there's a very strong case that can be made about seafood being a more eco-friendly option to menu. But for whatever reason, that's not really getting through to food service operators. So there's a messaging issue here as well that I see, whether it's marketing or outreach or giving customers inspiration. It does seem, I take away from this, that there's a little bit of flatness in inspiration, basically, among food service operators for what to do with seafood.
Well, and that's really interesting because you see in John Evans' story, he talked to analysts and he talked to distributors, and what they said was, you know, suppliers and operators need to get together on innovation. And when you think about the shift I just talked about a little earlier from the higher end element of food service to the lower end, the lower end doesn't have chefs, so to speak. I mean, what they are is they're restaurants who just produce, you know, what's already kind of ready to go. They throw it in a fryer, they do whatever they have to do, they assemble a burger, whatever. That area is where innovation can make a huge difference. And I think, you know, reading through John's story and some of the comments, I think that's what these operators are looking for. And that's surely what the seafood companies will have to address if they want to stay in these new growing segments that they're facing right now.
Now, it is the Lent season, which continues to be a time of year where seafood sales spike in majority Catholic countries. But in the U.S., that has remained a big season for all kinds of reasons. Part of it's religious, but then it's almost become kind of a tradition, I guess you could say, John, that it's just this is when a lot of restaurants do their promotions and try to get consumers into their doors. One sector that always benefits from this is the Alaska pollock sector, and it does look like this year, and this is some good signs for you know, a segment of the industry that desperately needs some help, is you do see the fast food chains that have white fish sandwiches that have your, you know, your fillet of fish and whatever Burger King calls theirs. But you see that they're actually doing a lot more. And the pollock association, the genuine Alaska pollock producers, they've said that this is the most that they've seen since pre-COVID pandemic. So that's probably a good sign. But, you know, we're not seeing the same promotions yet on shrimp. that's kind of an area too that needs to really, I think food service operators really need to start kicking back up if they're going to start, if the shrimp industry is going to have any hope of seeing more recovery.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, Lent started on February 14th. It ends on March 28th. So, you know, it's roughly 40 days. And yes, just like years in the past, you're right. You're so right. It's become traditional now for restaurants in general, but especially fast food and fast casual, to do a limited time offer of something seafood-esque, right? And as you mentioned, it looks like it's shaping up to be a very strong year for the pollock guys, in the sense that there's a lot of promotion at the Burger Kings and the McDonald's and those of the fish sandwiches. So we'll see what the numbers look like when it's all said and done. But that's really good news. Now, to touch on shrimp, I it's kind of amazing there isn't more shrimp promotion out there at food service right now, given the prices that we've seen the last half of last year and the availability. But it's not like there aren't shrimp promotions tied to Lenten season, but it almost feels like there should be twice as many as I've been seeing out there. So, yeah, I'm not sure what all the reasons are for that, but I would say that's a situation. I mean, we all go out to restaurants, you know, it's just part of the day or whatever. It's astounding how expensive restaurants are right now to me. And they have been for a long time. It just didn't happen overnight. But you can see how that shift from the higher end to the lower end had to happen, because people just, they can't go out and drop the money on a restaurant meal that the restaurants are asking for. And the restaurants are asking for it not because they're gouging. They've got higher food costs, sure, and they've got higher labor costs. Minimum wages are hiking up, across the country and things like that. So I sit here and I wonder, okay, so will restaurant prices have to come down, or will consumers move up to them, but just really not at the level they ever did? And that's kind of where we are right now.
And huge, huge implications for seafood ultimately, and the kinds of seafood that's sold, what's being processed, so many different things. So we'll keep a close eye on it. Turning to M&A, joining us on the podcast today is Ignacio Kleiman. He's the managing partner and founder of Antarctica Advisors. It's a boutique M&A seafood specialist. And Ignacio, we're asking you on the podcast today because we want to get some guidance and give some guidance to the industry. A lot of companies out there may be looking to sell out. The founder has been there for many, many years, maybe. The next generation isn't that interested in taking over. Companies looking for bolt-on acquisitions. So let's just start from the very basics. It's not like me putting a sign in front of my yard to sell my house. It's a little more complex than that, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's not like, you know, it has some similarities to selling a house, but it's 100 times more complex. You know, you have to, you know, first, obviously, you know, it's the whole topic of confidentiality. And second is, you know, how to actually even execute something like this that has, you know, financial aspects, economic aspects, emotional aspects, strategic aspects, you know, tax aspects to it. So all of those facets of this process make it, you know, complicated, makes it long. But again, you know, that's why we're here to handhold people through this process. And then, you know, it's the whole, pinpointing of, you know, how much should I sell my company for? And what structure and how do I get paid? So all of those things have to be taken into account in addition to risk and finding the right buyer and taking care of your employees and your suppliers and your clients.
You said something interesting there. Emotional aspects. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you guys know the industry very well, and most of the companies here that form the industry, they are either family owned or founder owned, and or they have a component of family ownership. Very few, you know, highly institutionalized or listed companies in our industry. So I would say that 90% of the transactions that we advise on are family owned, and therefore, you know, emotions do play a role. And again, you know, part of what we do is to be, you know, a financial advisor, investment banker, and part is, you know, trusted friend, you know, rabbi, and whatever it, you know, people need in order to make this transition, right? I mean, it's not easy sometimes to sell, you know, your own baby that you founded, you know, 20, 30 years ago, or your father's company that you inherited and you grew. So the emotions do play a role, and again, I think that that's why also, you know, a player of our size, it's a little bit more helpful than, you know, a large, you know, bank from Wall Street sometimes.
So the M&A climate has been very interesting over the last several years. When you look back, say 15 to 20, it's kind of remarkable how fragmented the industry truly was, and that's changed dramatically. And seems to be speeding up in recent years. But where are we in the life cycle of the industry consolidation, in your view?
Yeah, I'm going to answer in two parts. First, you have to understand the structure of this industry, and particularly from two different angles. One is seafood is really a collection of many different verticals that produce different types of seafood, and they are in many cases non-correlated, right? I mean, if you are a producer of vaname in Ecuador, and you are a, you know, a fishing company for cod in Iceland, yes, they are both seafood, but they are absolutely unrelated to each other in any way, shape, or form, pretty much. So that is one thing that makes this industry particular, right, as opposed to other verticals in animal protein, such as pork, poultry, or beef. You know, the second thing is, you know, seafood is produced where seafood is produced, but it's consumed in most cases in other markets. So it's heavily exported, traded, you know, in addition to that is processed. So, you know, it's a very complicated, you know, both of those things, you know, merge together to have a very complicated industry structure, you know, a complicated value chain as well. And therefore that has, you know, over decades generated different, many different players, right? And as players also get bought out, others, you know, pop up as well. So I think that there is a lot of runway. I think there's a lot of runway still in terms of consolidation. You know, both horizontally, in the form of integration for the industry to become more efficient, and also in terms of the value chain itself.
Ignacio, as everybody knows, the cost of money has been high this past year or so. And, you know, borrowing obviously is expensive. And I'm wondering what you see for, you know, the coming year as far as, you know, interest rates and the ability to borrow at reasonable rates.
Yeah, again, I think that 2023 was, you know, the year where, you know, the M&A market was hit the hardest because there was no clear expectation on when the Fed was going to stop raising the cost of money. Having said that, you know, it seems to be pretty clear that, you know, that cycle, you know, has reached a peak. And then the expectation is that now we are on the other side of the curve where, you know, over the next, you know, 12 to 18 months, we're going to start seeing a decrease in the cost of money. So I think that is going to be, very positive for the M&A market. And we're going to see an acceleration of consolidation here. And I would say not only from strategic players, but also I think that we're going to see a more aggressive comeback into the market of the private equity players as well. I mean, it was very, for a strategic player, for somebody from the trade, as they are called as well, the cost of money is relevant because it affects their cash flow and ability to execute, and make acquisitions. But they tend to take a very long and strategic view of their investments, and they have, in many cases, the capacity to generate synergies and savings. In the case of private equity, in many cases, they are just looking for the first platform to enter the industry, and therefore they don't benefit from that right at the beginning, so the cost of money hit them harder.
Ignacio, just taking us back to the process for selling a company. Indulge me for a second, if you would. We have Fiorillo Seafood Company. We have a very, very aging founder in John Fiorillo. So what is your role when Mr. Fiorillo comes hobbling over to you saying, I think I'm ready to sell out? What steps do you take at the beginning of that process?
Yeah, the first thing that we would tell Mr. Aging Fiorillo, Mr. Fiorillo here, is you should have come to us when you were younger. And, the truth is that when you have a family-owned or individual-owned company, the importance of that individual or that family is very relevant to the business itself, right? I mean, and therefore, in many cases, buyers don't really like, writing a check and getting the key to the house. They will ask you for some transitional period where, that wisdom and experience and whatnot is passed on, to the new owner or to the more junior members of the existing management team or so, right? So, the first thing is, be conscious that, it's not the same thing and you're not in the same position of strength to negotiate when you are a 70-year-old owner, a 60-year-old owner, or a 55-year-old owner. The pressures are different. And when I say transitional period, in many cases, you're talking about at least a couple of years, and it's pretty standard to discuss even a five-year transition. So important for private owners to understand that. So that's what we would have told Mr. Old, aging Mr. Fiorillo here.
Then you step in. And how are you identifying who might be a potential buyer? Obviously, you've been doing this a long time. You have the network. But do you have a list of potential buyers on tap that you know are hunting or have come to you and told you they're looking for this or that?
Yeah, let me take one step back, because there's an in-between which is, that comes before that question there, which is, the first thing that we have to do is, identify and agree on the goals for the transaction, right? Are you trying to find are you trying to monetize 100% of your holdings? Are you trying to find, a new house for your business or your employees? What are the factors that will affect your decision making? Are you trying to do something very quiet, or are you trying to do something that is more open, and then you can maximize the proceeds that you can get from an eventual sale, right? I mean, there's a spectrum of options that you have, selling, totally, partially, in one shot, in different stages, and also, what is the degree of flexibility as a seller that you will have through this process in order to get as close as possible to what we call your ideal transaction, right? I mean, you have an ideal situation, and then, the world is not ideal, right? And therefore, you have to see what degree of flexibility you're going to have on, in the different aspects of the transaction in order to effectively find a solution that is acceptable to you as a seller. And in some cases, it's money. In some cases, it's growth. In some cases, it's immediate payment. In some other cases, it's protecting the community. Or the employees, or having family members remain in the business. There are a number of factors there that have to be taken into account. So it's not a straightforward. It's all very, very much tailor made, and listening to your client is very important in this case. I mean, when you're doing a more corporate like straight spin-offs, many of those factors don't count. But when you're dealing with founder-owned or family-owned companies, they do. So now, let's assume that we already established and agreed with our client on what those goals are. Only then we can start the process of identifying who the potential or the right potential buyers would be. And on that front, also, the world is not ideal once again. And somebody who, last year may have been a perfect buyer, this year they may not have the appetite, financial capability, time, market conditions or whatnot to be present or to be a viable buyer. So it's important, to know, as many people in the industry as possible to understand very well what, this universe of potential buyers is thinking. What their timing is, what their appetite is and whatnot, so that you can really narrow down the number of people that you reach out to and maximize also the chances that, the people you are contacting are going to be interested in the transaction that you're bringing to the market, right? Under the terms that you're also bringing the transaction to the market.
Ignacio, tell us about valuation. A lot of times you'll read about transactions, it's X times EBITDA. So explain to us how valuation of companies works and that process.
Correct. Yeah, there are many different ways to value a company depending on the company's own characteristics. It is a mistake just to go and say, oh, my company's worth, seven times. Because the question is seven times what and why? And why do you think that your company's worth that level, right? And people, unfortunately, because it makes our life more difficult sometimes, they just go for they think that a rule of thumb is actually the way things always work, And again, some companies you can value primarily based on multiples, which means how many times the cash flow of the company a buyer would be willing to pay for it, or similar to when you talk about price to earnings in public markets, how many years in advance are you getting in your pocket? And some other companies you cannot do that. I mean, because they otherwise they would show as negative equity, which is not reasonable for any seller. And you have to find other methods of valuation, being, capacity, utilization, quota value, value of the fleet, replacement values, premiums, to book value. There are different tools and approaches that we use that adapt to the company situation. So it's not a cookie cutter. It's really, a little bit of a science with a big background of art behind it. And again, just to give you an idea, because, I know that people out there are always asking, but in any case, what is the value of my company or what is the multiple? To give you a rough idea, multiples tend to be higher at the beginning of the value chain, where, seafood is produced, raw materials, either because you have quotas or because you have, tracts of land that allow you to produce, with certain levels of efficiency. And those companies, the raw material producers, in general, over time, right, because of fluctuations as well, they tend to have also higher margins. And therefore, they tend to have also, you know, higher barriers to entry. And in many cases, they demand more capital investment in order to be set up. So they tend to be, and I keep on using the word, the verb tend, they tend to be more valuable than, you know, companies along the value chain or downstream the value chain, where you take that raw material from different suppliers and then you convert it, you know. And then again, it depends, you know, how much value you add to the product and how solid your margins and wide your margins are. And then as you move downstream the value chain, you find the, you know, the pure importer distributor that just brings, you know, a product in and out, and their value add is known in the market. There's no product conversion, there's no raw material production, and therefore, in general, you're talking about, you know, substantially narrower margins that tend to be more volatile as well. So it's a question of, and I'm going to be technical here, of quality of earnings as well, right? So it's how much, you know, how much profitability can you generate? How sustainable your profitability is? How protected is that profitability to market swings, right? And how fast are you able to grow this profitability? Everything has to do with cash generation. It's not a question of, you know, who's got the largest top line, but is the one who's got the juiciest, you know, sustainable margins there. That's what makes you more or less valuable. You know, and sometimes there are deviations to that that have to do with, you know, very strong brands that may help you be more protected in the market. But in our industry, there are very few players that count on that.
Where are you seeing the hot spots right now for consolidation in seafood? Where's the action going to come from in, say, the next 1 to 3 years?
Yeah, I see a lot of interest from, you know, raw material producers, either, you know, fishing companies, aquaculture companies, trying to integrate downstream into the market and start controlling, reaching more control of, you know, where their product goes, how, you know, capturing more margin, disintermediating the market a bit, and getting closer to the end consumer. You know, particularly, you know, from overseas players, that they like the U.S. market because it produces, you know, it generates more growth than the European one. There is going to be also, you know, consolidation in distribution continues to be. Even the largest guys are not that large, and there's a question of efficiency. You know, when you're in distribution, efficiency is everything because you don't have wide margins that allow you to make, you know, big mistakes there, right? You know, your margin of safety is lower. I think that there's going to be eventually consolidation or changing ownership, you know, in land-based, you know, land-based companies. Also probably in open sea companies that are bringing new species or new technologies. You know, there's a need for capital there, some, you know, to keep growing, to become more efficient, to grow faster, and to become commercially viable, right? And something that, you know, we have not seen, and I've been, you know, I've been saying for many years is, you know, I think that strong North American companies, they have to be able to go and integrate with overseas companies as well. I mean, it's been the case more of foreign players, you know, moving into the U.S. and very few North America, I should say, U.S. and Canada, very few players from North America and Canada really aggressively, you know, securing resources overseas. It's been 90% one way, with a few exceptions. You know, somebody like a Cook that's been going the other direction, right?
So, Ignacio, I want to ask you about one particular region, and that's Alaska. As everybody's aware, the major companies up there have been Having a tough time the last year or more, and you know, plants are up for sale, et cetera, et cetera. What's your perspective on what we might see there going forward over the next few years?
Yeah, thanks for the question here. Alaska, unfortunately, they have had it, you know, very hard, right? And it's one of those historical times where many of the unrelated different species have been hit at the same time for different reasons, right? I mean, clearly, you know, the salmon, white salmon has been hit hard, you know, 2 years in a row, and that, you know, while the process of consolidation and efficientization there had started, they didn't have, I don't think, enough time to complete it before, you know, they got financially hit over the last couple of years, which is unfortunate because they were on the right track. So I think that it's going to be, you know, further consolidation there. The question is, you know, who's going to be in a position to consolidate with the other party, or is it going to be, you know, merger of equals without cash just to achieve efficiencies and whatnot? You know, the Pollock guys have been also a little bit affected, you know, the crab guys affected as well, you know, for local reasons or for, you know, global reasons. Amendment 80 companies, many of them are not making a lot of money, you know, cod has been affected as well. So it's a little bit of a rarefied environment in Alaska, and eventually will have to be worked out, right? But I don't think it is going to take just one season. I think it's going to take, you know, a lot of creativity by the different players, and maybe bringing some capital from the outside or some other operators from the outside to supplement, you know, the existing players with capital. But the status quo of many years will have to change, and that may require, you know, egos to be put aside and become more practical, or people finally decide that they are going to exit the industry, right? But there's a need for efficiency and re-strengthening the capital base of the Alaskan, you know, seafood industry there. Having said that as well, I think what is lacking dramatically is government support. It's amazing how, you know, little government support they have been receiving, particularly in terms of adjusting the laws to new realities to allow companies to also become more efficient, right? I mean, renew fleet, build plant, change plants, you know, make it more energy efficient and whatnot. And while the private sector is obviously should always be in the lead, but it's, you know, it's difficult in the U.S. It's expensive, and that is not really helping the economy there. I mean, a Canadian company can go and build, you know, a nice boat for $70 million in Turkey, you know, with subsidies, or in Spain, you know, with subsidies or a, you know, market rates, and here would cost you double in the U.S. So they have it pretty tough.
Ignacio, what other regions do you see as kind of hot right now? What other sectors or our countries are in a similar position to Alaska, where there's a lot of activity and there's going to be a lot of consolidation?
I think that Europe continues to consolidate. They particularly because they are, you know, again, their operating costs have increased in terms of labor cost, energy cost, and whatnot, and they don't enjoy high levels of growth. So I think that they will continue to consolidate. I don't know the UK that much, but, you know, again, they are having a tough time as well. But I think we'll see more in the US. I think there's a lot of opportunity in the US to become much more efficient, right? And there are a lot of, you know, medium-sized companies, each one of them, you know, with a full, you know, administrative infrastructure, each one of them, you know, selling, you know, a few products as opposed to a full portfolio. being price takers and being at the mercy of the retailers. So I think the U.S. market will be pretty dynamic over the next few years until it becomes more efficient. I mean, think about it. In chicken, you probably have, four leading players. In pork and beef, you have, three, four leading players. In seafood, you have, 50. So that's why we do not have any type of negotiating power with the retailers, right? I mean, see what happened, with in Vaname shrimp, where, the retailers have been keeping prices high, and that, put a lot of pressure on importers and distributors.
Okay, putting you on the spot as we wrap up here, tell us about your most challenging deal.
One of our most challenging deals, it was actually last year, where we had, we did a cross-border deal where we had, international owners and US-based owners, same, with international buyers and US-based buyers, and everybody had, different objectives. Everybody had different, tax situations, different views and whatnot. And it was a transaction where you had to meet, the needs of six different stakeholders in a transaction. So, it took a lot of knitting together a good transaction, a good structure, but it was completed, right?
Okay, so bottom line, is it a good time for Fiorillo to sell out of his seafood company?
I think that is, I again, it wasn't a bad time last year. We were very busy, 22 and 23. I think it's going to be a bit of an easier time, this year, next. The timing has to do more with owners' needs, right? There's always access to capital, and there's always access to financing and access to buyers. The worst thing that you can do is not sell when your company is doing well. If your company is doing well, that's the time to consider selling. Don't wait until you peaked, and then the only thing that you have is, an increased possibility of downside, because buyers want companies with bright futures, right? So you have to leave a little bit on the table for the next guy, and sell, part of what you sell is hope, right, and future. So I think you have to define, your selling time based on that and based on your own personal needs, like I said, and then, this closes a little bit the cycle of this conversation, which is, don't wait until you are, 65, 70, because you feel great, and you want to, and you feel that you can put 10 more years into the company. Think about the company, think about the employees, and think about, the additional time that you will have to dedicate the company even after you sell it. Because, buyers, part of the value of the company is your own knowledge and experience, and buyers want to get that. And they do it through a transitional period there.
Ignacio, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you guys for having me.
Well, that wraps up this week's edition of the IntraFish podcast. Remember, you can find us 24/7 on IntraFish.com, where we have coverage from all around the globe. If you are going to be at the Boston Seafood Show, make sure and register for our event, the Seafood Leadership Breakfast. That's on March 11th. We have a fantastic lineup of speakers. We have Highliner, Trident, Whole Foods, Hy-Vee, Acme Smoked Fish, Pittman Seafood, Slade Gordon. The list goes on. So go to IntraFishEvents.com and you can get your ticket there. It is limited seating and it is filling up very fast. Okay, folks, also remember to subscribe to this podcast. Just go to Apple Podcast, click follow, and then every time we put out an episode, it's going to go right to your phone. You can, of course, listen directly onto our site. If you do go to Apple Podcasts or Google Play, make sure and rate us. We have thick skin. If it's a low rating, go for it. If it's a high rating, go for it. But that helps other people find us. Thanks again, everyone, for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.